is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo arrived in South Korea after meeting with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un and Pyongyang earlier in the day. We get more from VOA's Steve Miller in Seoul.
U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo met for about 2 hours Sunday with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un in Pyongyang. Kim said it was nice to see Pompeo again and that the day promised a good future. Pompeo did not respond to questions about the meeting, but one official on the trip described it as better than the last time. Pompeo is now in South Korea, where he meets with President Moon Jae-in and Foreign Minister Kang Kyung-hwa Saturday evening to brief them on his meeting. Steve Miller, VOA News, Seoul.
Judge Brett Kavanaugh is now U.S. Supreme Court Justice Kavanaugh, sworn in late Saturday night. The U.S. Senate voted to approve Brett Kavanaugh's nomination to the Supreme Court following weeks of controversy over sexual assault accusations and attacks on his character and temperament. During a political rally in the state of Kansas, President Trump talked with reporters about the confirmation.
This is a very exciting time. Any time you have a chance to put a Supreme Court justice in position, and in this case, I think he's going to be a great, great Supreme Court Justice for many years. It's a very exciting time.
Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat, spoke after the confirmation as well.
Judge Kavanaugh's confirmation is a low moment for the Senate, for the court, for the country.
Kavanaugh was confirmed in a 50-48 vote on the Senate floor. Turkish officials have concluded that Jamal Khashoggi, the Saudi Arabian journalist who disappeared, was killed in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul last week when he went there to get a document for his upcoming marriage. His fiancé says that he went inside the building but never came out. This is VOA News. International aid is arriving in many of the devastated communities in Indonesia, hard hit by an earthquake and tsunami just over a week ago. Indonesian Red Cross doctor Hadet Abdul.
We are the first men here because at the first time after the disaster in this central Celebes, the assessment are focused on Palu.
The death toll has climbed to more than 1,700 in Indonesia's central Sulawesi province. Brazilians have been at the poll at a time when the economy is only slowly recovering from a prolonged recession, and more than 13 million people remain without work. The far-right congressman, Jair Bolsonaro, led in the polls going into the election. Mark Jones is a Latin American scholar at Rice University.
Jair Bolsonaro, he's been a congressman for quite some time, and he's seen as, at least traditionally was seen as a very fringe actor. But in a country that's hungering for someone who's a non-traditional politician, who's not tied to elites, that is essentially an anti-system candidate, he's providing the vehicle for them to cast their vote.
And second in the polls is the former Sao Paulo mayor Fernando Haddad of the ruling Workers' Party, which has won the last four presidential elections. A 5.9 magnitude earthquake struck northwest Haiti Saturday. That killed at least 11 people and injured more than 130. The U.S. Geological Survey says that the shallow quake hit 19 kilometers from the Port-de-Paix on the country's north coast. The wife of a missing Interpol president says that he sent her a photo of a knife before his disappearance, and that's prompting them to think that something afoul has happened to him. And again, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo saying that he and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un made unspecified progress Sunday toward an agreement for the North to give up its nuclear weapons program, although there was no immediate indication whether Pompeo had managed to arrange a much-anticipated second summit between Kim and U.S. President Donald Trump. Mr. Trump tweeted from Washington and cited progress on the agreements he made with Kim at their June meeting and said that he looks forward to seeing Chairman Kim again in the near future, arriving in Seoul after several hours in Pyongyang on his fourth visit to North Korea. Pompeo tweeted that he had a good trip and that he and Kim continue to make progress on agreements made at the Singapore summit. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
I think the result will be legally justified, but there will be no legitimacy at all. If out of 26 million Cameroonians, only about a million elect a president.
Paul Biya seeks re-election in the Cameroonian presidential vote Sunday.
We don't support violence in our country. We are going to fight a war of words, a war of ideas against other people's ideas. I think that's enough.
An opposition leader calls on the government to immediately close down the University of Zambia over students' protests.
This administration is saying that there is an important asset that we have. That is the target of development.
Sierra Leonean President Julius Maada Bio introduces measures to jumpstart the economy. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Incumbent Cameroonian President Paul Biya is widely tipped to win re-election in Sunday's vote. Seven opposition candidates are seeking to wrestle power from the 85-year-old leader who has been president for the last 36 years. The presidential vote is being held despite the ongoing crisis in the English-speaking parts of the country. For more about the election, I reach Evaristus Morfa, a Cameroonian lawyer based in the capital Yaoundé.
Generally speaking, the country is not at peace at all. Up north, there are upheavals from Boko Haram. The two Anglophone regions are fighting for their restoration. Municipal parliament and parliamentary elections were postponed so that peace could be restored for those elections to be carried on. We thought logically the presidential elections were supposed to be postponed as well. However, government went ahead to organize presidential elections. To tell you the truth, in the Anglophone regions, more effective elections took place. In the BLM, materials were deposited in the field in Menji, and they discovered that there was nobody there, and they carried the materials away. In Yaoundé, there was peaceful atmosphere, even though all over, at road junctions, you could find armored cars, soldiers armed to the teeth. I don't know what for, but actually speaking, there was calm and fear.
Did you go to where you were originally scheduled to vote, somewhere in the villages, as most Cameroonians do?
I registered to vote in the BLM. It is in the BLM that I just told you that elections material were deposited, but they were never opened because the people have gone into the bushes. Some are dispersed all over the country. There was nobody to vote, and so I myself, I couldn't take the risk because even getting to the BLM is practically impossible.
Elikam said that places where there seem to be security concerns, there will not be elections held there. However, the elections will proceed. How are people reacting to this, particularly when the presidential election being held in several parts of the capital and the commercial capital, Douala, are proceeding peacefully without incident?
However, I gather if presidential elections are limited to only certain parts of the country, it goes without saying that where elections are not taking place, government has not considered that to be part of Cameroon. We also gather that in some of the polling stations, especially in Douala, the electoral cards for the opposition party got finished before time. There was trouble because they are supposed to close the polls at 6 o'clock. It's not yet 6 o'clock, but some ballot papers, especially SDF, are not more in the polling stations.
So how credible do you think this presidential election will be?
Going by what the Minister of Communication said, Issa Chiruma, he has even said that a few groups of people have decided that if they lose, there will be trouble. It's just intimidation. And the Minister of Territorial Administration said CPDM has won beforehand. that what we are doing is just a formality. He did say that. Coming to your question, I think the result will be legally justified, but there will be no legitimacy at all. If out of 26 million Cameroonians, only about a million elect a president, can that president be legitimate, even out of those who registered, if not all, or a good portion vote, can you still say the person to be elected is legitimate with all of this and the propaganda and intimidation that loom around with things? And I personally think that it's a whole fact.
Evarister Smofa is a Cameroonian lawyer. He spoke with me from Yaoundé. The leader of the Zambian Opposition Republican Progressive Party, or RPP, has called on the government to immediately close down the University of Zambia. James Lukuku says it appears some outside groups are influencing the students to create chaos. His remarks came after students held late-night protests against a delay in their semester meal allowances, which the students say should have been paid in August. At least four students have been reported dead following the protests. For more on his call for the closure of the university, I reached James Lukuku in the Zambian capital, Lusaka.
We are calling for the immediate closure of the University of Zambia because it has come to our knowledge and information that there are underhand political methods that are being used to sponsor these comrades, our students of the University of Zambia, for violence. Remember, it's very, very questionable that they are to stage a demonstration in the night. We don't know who was advocating that they should do a demonstration in the night. And you're going to understand that right now in this country, we are sitting on a powder keg, whereby anybody can lift up the fuse because of the tension which is existing now. So this kind of action by these university students can trigger a civil strife. Because if we are going to have a civil strife, it's not me that is going to be spared or anybody else that is going to be spared. It's going to be a disaster for Zambia.
But James, your call for the immediate closure of the university has dropped sharp criticisms from the university students themselves. Some of them have vowed never to vote for you, or they will campaign against you in the next round of elections. What is your reaction to that?
I don't need support from students that are there believing in violence. I need support from outstanding citizens of Zambia. There is no need for me to be pro-violence or to support actions that are not in accordance with peace for me to gain support from the university students. Whether they say they are not going to support me or not, the fact still remains that I cannot be there to bend the principles of our Republican Progressive Party just because I want to gain support from the university of Zambia students. They are not the only citizens in this nation. Remember, I staged the demonstration against the Chinese invasion of this nation. It was peaceful.
You talked about some people using these students to create chaos and tension at the university, which you think could spiral into something untoward in Zambia. Do you have proof of what you are saying? And why wouldn't you present it to the Zambian police to investigate?
The police have just investigated their investigation. And I'm sure this issue of money exchanging hands in the circles of a smaller number of students is in public domain. Because the police have done it and a few other people have done those investigations. And that is why we are advising fellow politicians to desist from funding violence. It is in public domain. People know that those students that instigated the riots of 4th October were funded by people that are unknown even to me. But you know that somebody is actually funding them. This information is available, and I'm sure the police will have it. And that's why we are saying, during this time of investigation, let them investigate and find the source of that funding which is going to students to intoxicate them. so that they should start accepting this violence which they are indulging themselves in this time around. I repeat that in this, I should say, we don't support violence in our country. We are going to fight a war of words, a war of ideas against other people's ideas. I think that's enough.
James Lukuku is the leader of the Zambian Opposition Republican Progressive Party, or RPP. He spoke with me from Lusaka. Sierra Leonean President Julius Maada Bio says his administration is introducing measures to jumpstart the economy, create jobs, and reduce unemployment. His remark followed a series of meetings with American investors, where he underscored the opportunities and business-friendly environment in Sierra Leone. I sat down for a talk with President Maada Bio and began by asking him about the economy he inherited when he was elected as president about 5 months ago.
It's been extremely difficult taking over an economy that was so battered at the time. But because we are committed, and I made a pledge to the people of the Sierra Leone that we ensure that we have efficient political and economic management of the state, I have set in motion a series of homegrown reforms to help manage the economy.
So what steps are you taking to mitigate some of the effect of having no money, public sector workers have not been paid fully well, the previous government borrowing money to pay public sector workers, heavy burden, as you call it. How are you resolving some of these challenges?
With three executive orders, I was able to start taking in some money. Domestic revenue mobilization was a serious problem because there are too many leakages in the system. So we instituted serious measures to make sure that we can take in as much as we can from internal revenue. We have also put in place reforms to make sure that all departments put their money in the consolidated fund. We are also managing expenditure. With these few, we have been able to keep running the state and to even go to the point of supporting or launching the free education program without a single cent from anywhere else around the world except in Sierra Leone.
You talked about free quality education for Sierra Leonean students. How sustainable is this? And because, you know, starting a program or a policy is easy to do. When you are not there, another president might say, okay, we don't have money to do that, so we go back to the old system. How sustainable would this policy be in your administration and years to come?
In fact, it is the flagship program project of this particular administration. What basically we are doing is to put premium on the human capital, which has been neglected for a very long time. Because when we talk about Sierra Leone, what most people think about immediately is diamonds, gold, iron ore, bauxite, rutile, you name it. Or this administration is saying that there is an important asset that we have. That is the target of development, the human being. The only way to make us useful in this modern world is to have education, quality education. So what we want to do is to make sure that we lay a solid foundation, not one that is prescribed from outside, but one that is a result of our own internal brainstorming, which we have done. And if any government were to come and want to change that, I don't think you are going to be in power for too long, because the people are feeling the benefit. The kids are very happy. They are able to go to school. And we know that education is good for personal and also national development.
Mr. President, you talked about corruption. You recently established a commission to look into acts of public corruption. Now, some of your critics are saying this is a ploy by your administration to go after your predecessors. Just a witch hunt, they said. How do you respond to that?
Corruption, I have said, is a threat to national security. We are really an out of a civil war that lasted for 11 years in that country. We cannot continue to commit the same mistakes that were committed by our predecessors. We have to check corruption. And the impunity with which the leadership has been corrupt is what we want to nip in the bud now. The judicial inquiry which we have instituted is going to look at those who have been involved in acts of corruption. They are going to be supported by our own local judges to look at it in a free and fair manner. Should anybody in my administration be involved in that, he or she is going to be to have his a day in the court and account for that.
Julius Maada Bio is the Sierra Leonean president. He spoke with me from here in Washington, D.C. Delegates from 148 parties to the World Health Organization's Framework Convention on Tobacco Control are calling for new heated tobacco products on the market to be regulated in the same way cigarettes and other tobacco products are. For viewing, Lisa Schlein has more on the outcome of a week-long anti-tobacco conference in Geneva.
Heated tobacco products are not e-cigarettes. They are products that contain nicotine and other chemicals which are inhaled by users through the mouth. The tobacco industry markets these devices as being less harmful than regular cigarettes. But the head of the convention secretariat, Vera da Costa e Silva, says there is no evidence that HTPs are less harmful than conventional tobacco products. She says they are tobacco products in the same way as cigarettes and should be subject to the same regulations imposed on standard tobacco products under the treaty.
Government should implement a ban on advertising, promotion, and sponsorship, that they should implement smoke-free policies, that they should increase awareness of the dangers of tobacco products. So parties to the treaty are legally bound to the provision of the treaty and they should regulate heated tobacco accordingly.
Da Costa tells VOA the tobacco industry is marketing heated tobacco products as a harm reduction strategy. She says many are sold with flavors which appeal to young people. For now, she says, the products are mainly being marketed in developed countries.
But they are already being marketed very aggressively with high lobby, and there are many concerns, lots of concerns raised by African countries, Latin American countries, Asian countries, that don't feel they are prepared for this epidemic of heated tobacco products.
Da Costa says evidence is accumulating that the nicotine inhaled from HTPs is unhealthy, causing dependence and disease. The long-term health impact from vaping is not yet clear, but the World Health Organization notes illnesses related to regular tobacco products prematurely kill more than 7 million people every year. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Want to relax, unwind, or charge up? Then listen to Music Time in Africa this weekend. It'll do all that for you and more. I'm Heather Maxwell. I know good music. And Africa is my passion. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for 1 hour of commercial-free Pan-African music of the highest caliber. You get great music, music news, and amazing artist interviews from rising stars to superstars. This listen will take you places. So do it. Join me for Music Time in Africa, your weekend destination.
A In Africa, non-communicable diseases are one of the biggest reasons for premature deaths. That is, deaths for those between the ages of 40 and 70. Healthcare experts on the continent say the problem is less science than the capacity to care for people. For VOA, Eugene Wumana reports from the Rwandan capital, Kigali.
Looking at this different definition, so I did
Medical experts say no amount of research can solve Africa's healthcare problems if there is no practical will to improve the medical infrastructure. Dr. Talela Salmiye is from Ibadan University in Nigeria.
It's not the clinic work, it's not the hospital work. It's more of policy changes and implementation of those policies to influence the lifestyle and the environment of each citizen.
Salmiye was one of 100 medical workers and researchers who gathered recently in Kigali to discuss ways to use new technology to improve healthcare in Africa. Dr. Diane Gashumba, Rwanda's health minister, understands the problem of political will, but she notes that Rwanda is making progress.
As you know, since 1994, the government of Rwanda has invested heavily in improving infrastructure. When you look at the number of hospitals we have today compared to what we had before 94, there is a huge difference. We have one or two hospitals per district. We know that there is a lot to do, there is still a lot to do, but the government is fully committed to improving infrastructure in the health sector. And every year, the government is increasing the budget that is allocated to health infrastructure.
Often the focus in Africa can be on emergencies created by communicable diseases such as HIV/AIDS, cholera, or Ebola. But heart disease, respiratory disease, and diabetes are major killers. One challenge some healthcare providers say is that impoverished governments can be dependent on international donors. Dr. Guida Landule, a neurologist from Bamako, says donor funds can come with conditions that limit the work of hospitals and researchers.
So the funding we often get is from outside organization to build infrastructure, but often they also have their own agenda, sometimes not meeting the local needs we might have. Often if they give you money, they give you guidelines, they give you their policy. So sometimes you have to abide by their guidelines and their policy to even get the money. So if local governments talk to local scientists to see what are the needs, you know, the same money they put for malaria can be put to research and then serve both malaria and the other rare diseases.
Many African nations are among of the world's poorest and struggle to provide basic care to their citizens. The World Health Organization says non-communicable diseases caused 15 million premature deaths worldwide last year, and 85% of them were in low- and middle-income countries, such as those in Africa. As part of the 2030 Agenda for Sustainable Development, the United Nations has recognized the importance of taking action against non-communicable diseases, especially in developing nations. Eugene Wimana for VOA News, Kigali.
Hello, I'm Linor Mudu, host of Health Chat. Next week on Health Chat, we'll discuss the burden of poor quality health systems worldwide and what can be done about it. Our guest is Dr. Margaret Crook of the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. For your questions, email us at healthchat@voanews.com. You can also reach us by phone to leave a message or to participate in the program. We will call you back. Dial the international code for the United States, then dial 202-205-9942. The U.S. country code is 1. Dial 45 after you hear the station ID. Health Chat, this Tuesday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection, and that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Juna, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. But first, policymakers and other leaders at the UN General Assembly focused on war and peace, human rights, migrants, nuclear proliferation and sustainable development. In the midst of these marquee issues, the necessary work of fighting crime on a global scale is sometimes overlooked. To find out more about how law enforcement helps fulfill the UN's mission in Africa, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Yuri Fedotov, director of the UN's Office of Drugs and Crime. Fedotov began by explaining what UNODC is and the many complex and interlocking challenges it faces.
Altogether, we have about 200, 250 staff working for UNODC in different projects and programs such as transnational organized crime, illicit drugs, trafficking in human beings, smuggling of migrants, wildlife and forest crime, piracy, prevention of terrorism, and of course, anti-corruption.
Is corruption a bigger problem in Africa than in other places?
In Africa, unfortunately, everything is big, but everything is interconnected. Drug trafficking is feeding transnational organized crime and terrorist groups such as Boko Haram and Shabab. And corruption is a sort of a generator for illicit money flows for all these criminal activities.
I know that a lot of pirate groups in the Gulf of Guinea are connected to Nigerian rebel factions. They often use the rationale of funding these rebel groups as a cover for their crimes, and then they even lose that rationale and become just out-and-out criminal organizations.
Indeed, this nexus between terrorism, crime, illicit drugs, piracy, it's a clear and present threat and danger for all countries in this region. But in some countries, the lack of support from the central government because of the insurgency. Local population is becoming dependent on organizations like Boko Haram in providing basic services. And that undermines the credibility of governments, of provincial authorities, but even state authorities. That is an area which needs to be addressed through implementation of Goal 16 of the Sustainable Development Goals, peaceful societies.
Tell me about the drug problem, because I don't normally hear about drugs as a crime in Africa as much as I do in Europe and North America.
Problem drug use is a recently new problem in Africa. Before, this continent used to be mostly a transit zone for drugs coming from Asia, from Afghanistan to East Africa, then to Europe, or from Latin America, cocaine, passing by West Africa, Sahel, and again Europe. But drug dealers started to settle their account with local criminals, not in cash, but also in kind. And now, in Central Africa, there are 2.5 million people addicted to drug, heroin, crack.
And what about opioids, or opiates, as we call them here in the United States, where addiction to them is a huge problem?
Opioids as well, but that is mostly in East Africa, in countries like Kenya and Tanzania and other countries. And there, of course, we're running programs of drug prevention, but also treatment, rehabilitation.
I can imagine that just as all these areas, for example, infrastructure, health, are really connected under the skin, even though they manifest in different domains, it must be similar for the UNODC as well, because as infrastructure improves, smuggling increases, and at the same time, health improvements and development are threatened when there is drug problems or war.
Precisely, and that's why we're trying to support coordination and cooperation between countries in Africa, establishing transnational crime units or global projects like container control, which helps to improve the border control, which helps to prevent illicit trafficking, smuggling, these criminal activities. The problem of migrants and migration starts somewhere in Africa, but it ends up in Europe. Traffickers, they're getting all their payments in advance, and then they're sending people to death in the Mediterranean.
I understand a lot of these pirates, especially in East Africa, have sort of moved into the human trafficking realm.
It's a very pertinent question. We had a successful counter-piracy program. And thanks to our program, we've been able to build prisons in Somalia, in Kenya. And now 1,000 pirates are serving their long sentences. And that is an achievement. But their boats are also used for other criminal activities, like smuggling of firearms, just regular contraband. So we upbuilt our counter-piracy program, but we made out of it a maritime crime program. We are coordinating this program from Sri Lanka, but of course it targets mostly East Africa. But also we started to work in West Africa, in the Gulf of Guinea, and we hope it will help countries in the region.
Yuri Fedotov is the director of the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime. He spoke with viewers Adam Phillips in New York. The UN World Food Programme reports the Kenyan government will assume full responsibility for organizing and implementing the school lunch programme it started in the country 40 years ago. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
Over the past four decades, the World Food Programme has been providing lunches to 1.6 million school children in arid and semi-arid areas of Kenya. For most of these children, the lunch they receive at school is their only hot meal of the day. WFP says school lunches for impoverished children play a crucial role in providing them with the nutritious food they need to remain healthy. It says these meals also act as an incentive for parents to send children to school. It notes children who are educated have a better chance of growing up to become productive adults. WFP spokesman Hervé Verhoesel says the distribution of school meals has been jointly organized with the Kenyan government over past years. He tells VOA the transition away from WFP's involvement started gradually a few years ago.
Then the government was starting step by step to take over a bit more and a bit more and a bit more. What's the best way to do to make sure that they have the capacity? We need to make sure the government have the capacity to take over such a program. And that's the case in Kenya. And $24 million for that, 4,000 schools, 1.6 million children, it's quite a budget for Kenya.
Verhoesel says the logistics of organizing such a large program and raising the money needed to run it is very complex and can be overwhelming. He says WFP welcomes the Kenyan government's decision to maintain this crucial program. He says his agency hopes other African countries, as well as nations in other regions of the world, will be able to do the same one day. Last year, the UN agency implemented and supported school feeding programs in 71 countries. WFP also directly provided school meals to 18.3 million children in 60 countries. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter. Good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. FIFA has suspended Sierra Leone from international football because of government interference in the running of the country's football association. The ban comes after the country's anti-corruption commission, SEC, barred two leading football officials from the governing body's offices. If the ban is not lifted before October 11th, Sierra Leone's 2019 Africa Cup of Nations qualifier in Ghana will be cancelled. The return fixture is scheduled for October 15th. Sierra Leone are one of four teams with 3 points in Group F, which also includes Ethiopia and Kenya. The SEC says that under Sierra Leone's law, both President Isha Johansson and General Secretary Christopher Kamara must vacate their posts until their case on corruption-related charges concludes. Both Johansson and Kamara have denied any wrongdoing. Elsewhere, Abdelal Hafidi scored his first Confederation Cup goal since March to give Raja Casablanca of Morocco a 1-0 semi-final first leg win away to Enyimba of Nigeria on Wednesday. He struck early in the second half in Aba to put Raja in a strong position in their semi-final. In the other game, Egypt's Al Masry were held to a goalless draw at home by AS Vita Club of DR Congo. The second leg matches will take place later this month. Vita Club has won every one of their home matches in this competition this season, and so will be confident of winning through after the second leg in Kinshasa. And Cameroon President Paul Biya has insisted his country will be ready to host next year's Africa Cup of Nations. Biya made the assurances to the president of the Confederation of African Football, CAF, Ahmed, during a meeting in Yaoundé on Tuesday. In return, Ahmed added that CAF has no plans to take the tournament away from Cameroon. Next year's Nations Cup is set to be the first to feature 24 teams and hosted in June and July rather than earlier in the year. Questions have been raised about whether Cameroon will have everything in place to host a successful event, especially in light of recent political unrest in the country. But Ahmed said the CAF does not have any other hosts planned for the Nations Cup. The CAF president was also thankful for former Cameroon captain Samuel Eto'o for arranging the meeting with the head of state. In another development, for the first time, the video assistant referees VAR will be applied for the finals of this season's CAF Interclub competitions, Toto CAF Champions League and Toto CAF Confederation Cup. This follows the approval of the CAF Executive Committee at its meeting last week in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt. The decision comes after the success of the premier implementation of the latest refereeing technology during the Toto CAF Super Cup last February between Wydad Athletic Club of Morocco and TP Mazembe of DR Congo in Casablanca. Finally, in athletics, Terenusha Dibaba, considered by many to be the world's greatest female distance runner, will run the Airtel Delhi Half Marathon, an IAAF Gold Label Road Race on Sunday, October 21st. The Ethiopian has won 3 Olympic gold medals and 5 world titles on the track, as well as 4 world cross-country titles as a senior. She's also 5,000 meters world record holder. In the wake of her third place finish at last month's Berlin Marathon, her third run inside 2 hours and 19 minutes over the classic distance in the past 18 months, she'll be chasing the Ethiopian half marathon record and the course record her compatriot Abdel Yashanen, who has been previously announced as running in the Airtel Delhi Half Marathon, reduced the Ethiopian half marathon record of 1 hour 5 minutes and 46 seconds in Copenhagen on the same day that Dibaba was running in the German capital over the full marathon distance. The Delhi course record has stood since 2009 at 1 hour 6 minutes and 54 seconds to Kenya's Mary Kaitane, but with Dibaba and Yashane in this year's race, along with a host of other strong runners, this standard must surely be in danger. Meanwhile, Dibaba's compatriot and fellow Ethiopian Hagos Gebhewet has been added to the men's elite field. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sport. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African Sport. Nightline Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, let we make a memory. Oh, I can feel it in my heart. Hey, feel it in my soul. And I can feel when we're apart. Girl, I want you to know when I'm with you.
Time. Oh, we won't give you any time. Yeah, leave you King is a ruler.
And I can be your one and only Queen Sheba.
Don't tell me how big as a Paulina. Go ask me in Angelina. Do as I want to say, Mina. Me love for you, then in a Medina. Take you down to Medina.
Time.
You love me when I get a dime.
Get a dime.
I won't give you any time.
Yeah, baby, don't know if you love me so much. I want to take you every day to the church. Love you from the bottom of my heart.
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. And now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Dramatic changes are taking place in Ethiopia, in the political, economic, social, and external sectors. However, as is so often the case, such changes are faced with serious challenges. And these challenges, if not addressed properly, can adversely affect these changes. That was the dilemma which confronted about 1,000 delegates at the Congress of the Ethiopian People's Revolutionary Democratic Front, EPRDF, when they met in the southern city of Awaza in Ethiopia. The conference concluded last Friday when Prime Minister Abe was elected. Prime Minister Abe Ahmed is the real harbinger of the dramatic changes in Ethiopia. And when he was elected last April in Ethiopia, he was the first from the Oromo ethnic group to lead Ethiopia in the modern era. The EPRDF is a coalition of four ethnic groups. And during the time of Prime Minister Meles, the Tigray ethnic group was in a dominant position. And since his election, there have been suggestions that the Eritrean Liberation Movement was not pleased with the ceding of the town of Badme to Eritrea in accordance with an international panel. But he went ahead, and his reconciliation with Eritrea has been acclaimed worldwide. Prime Minister Ahmed has also reached out to Sudan and Egypt with respect to the Grand Renaissance Dam, which is being built by Ethiopia on the Nile. And he has tried to reassure those two countries that the dam would not in any way affect the flow of the water to them. However, in the meantime, the construction of the dam has been slowed down when the manager of the dam surprisingly was found dead. There are also problems of corruption which are being now investigated. In June this year, there were grenade attacks in a rally which was being conducted by Prime Minister Ahmed. And there are also many ethnic violence in Ethiopia at the present time. This is why there is so much concern internationally that if not addressed properly, these changes which have been brought out by Prime Minister Ahmed might fall apart. And it is therefore gratifying that the Congress, in a secret ballot, elected Prime Minister Ahmed as the new chairperson of the ruling party. Prime Minister Ahmed has become a model modern African leader. And it is vital that the African continent should give him full support. In many of the statements made in the current session of the General Assembly by many African leaders, particularly those from East Africa, I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Saida Hamdoun, and our engineer for today, Tiang Wang, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, you don't show an indigent the way to his or your own house. I'm your host, Peter Clotet in Washington. Good evening, Africa.